It is the Sun Up Breakfast Show. My name is Steve, a.k.a. So Sick. And get that milk and milkshake. It is strawberry, banana, vanilla, caramel, and all the greatness that you need. 250 milliliters and 500 milliliters. Good morning, Dekazi.
Good morning. The moment you say strawberry, banana, I was going to say wheat and chocolate.
Yeah. I mean, when you program your mind, it's a terrible thing.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, getting 250 milliliters and 500 milliliters is a great way for you to enjoy something tasty. And you know how great milk is? It does your body good. It's good for your calcium. Good for your bone structure, everything. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good. So make sure you get that milk and milkshake. All right. So, you know, we talk about numbers, data, and all these things, and you know, we don't know really how important that is for anything that we do in our country. So in the studio, we have Pranish Desai. Good morning, Pranish. How are you doing?
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Dekazi, and good morning to all your listeners and viewers out there.
Yeah, thanks for joining us in the studio. I've been watching some of your interviews all across, you know, in different media platforms, and you know, it's nice to know that somebody is really into their numbers. So, you with that Good Governance Africa. Tell us more about Good Governance Africa. What is that about?
Yeah, so I'm a data analyst and researcher at Good Governance Africa, which is a applied research think tank which has a footprint all across Africa.
All across.
Yep. Okay. We have offices in Ethiopia, Ghana, Nigeria, and I work at the SADC office in South Africa, Johannesburg. So the sort of work we do is focused on research and policy analysis, but also we seek to guide governments, citizens, and the private sector in helping to build research networks and essentially planning so that we can guide them and help improve governance across the continent and also hopefully improve living standards as well.
Yeah, you talk about policies as well. I mean, a lot of you know, policies are always mentioned. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. How easy is it to get you know, governments to listen to some of your advice in terms of policies as an organization?
So it is obviously a challenge.
Yeah.
One of the issues about governance is that it's fundamentally about managing competing interests.
Yeah.
And that often poses a challenge in terms of how effective policymaking can be. But while we recognize that governance specifically is about managing interests, we also, our duty as a research think tank is to tell the truth and give broader coverage to facts and salient policy measures which can be taken to improve citizens' lives and the state of governance throughout Africa.
Now, I'm wondering, I mean, you're talking about data collection. I mean, how hard is it to get all this data, especially that, you know, some of the countries you're mentioning are some of the poorest in the world. And the infrastructure, the road networks, all these things, the IT is not really a big thing there as well. I mean, how do you get all this data?
So it is certainly a challenge. A lot of it is down to field workers who collect data, especially in processes such as national censuses. South Africa is just undergoing one of its national censuses right now, and there's another one scheduled in Zambia later this year. So it is a pretty large challenge in a lot of Africa. But what should also be acknowledged is that the continent has risen quite a bit from what is a pretty low base of statistics across the continent. About 70 years ago, after World War II, there was a lot of focus by new international organizations like the United Nations back then on finding out more about different regions across the world. At the time, they had Africa as the continent where they were least sure about how many people there are, where do these people live, and these sorts of things. But since then, especially after the waves of independence, which spread across the continent in the 1960s and 70s, Zambia obviously being one of the big countries which experienced independence in that period.
Yeah.
We did see national statistical offices and government departments like treasuries begin to develop their statistical infrastructure. And also there were a lot of international initiatives from places like the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa and newer institutions like the African Development Bank and the AU Commission. But one of the concerns which has been raised by many, including myself, is that the statistical capacity hasn't really improved much over the last 20, 30 years. So there's been a bit of a stagnation, and that's a pretty bad thing to stagnate on.
What do you think that is?
I think some of it's due to normal political problems, where people don't want to share and have access to knowledge that they do have. But some of it's also that sometimes these departments are badly funded, and there's sometimes, especially in places like a lot of Southern Africa and in more authoritarian regimes, a lot of political intervention within statistical capacities, so that governments want to sort of suppress economic information that will make them look bad, or they sort of fudge the data and fudge the figures, and that undermines the ability.
I'm surprised you said that, because I guess you as an organization are doing something that is needed to be done, and it gets do we even know how many people are in Zambia right now? Do we have the right figures for that?
That's where a process like a census helps out a lot. Your last one was in 2010, and so there's been a bit of a COVID delay, but also there were concerns around a lack of planning for that. Now, that's a big concern, because a census is really important. Not only does it help you find out how many people there are in your country and where they live, but it also tells you things like how to allocate budgets and resources for government planning.
I mean, if we did our last census 12 years ago, how often do you think we should do a census?
I think 10 years is a pretty standardized gap. So in that sense, it's not a disadvantage, because they require a lot of preparation, field work, and especially in something like COVID, you don't want to put field workers at risk as well due to exposure.
And we also had a gassing incident, so when that sense, it was supposed to start about 2 years or 3 years ago, a lot of people going to these areas were under threat because of how unstable people were at that time. They didn't trust anyone. All right, so speaking about that, I was watching your interview talking about, elections, a municipal election that was in South Africa. I mean, are you also part of, some of the stats that happened in our elections, especially last year's elections?
Yeah, so we looked with interest at what was a pretty important election in Zambia. We saw the highest turnout in about 15 years, and also the now incumbent president won the highest share of the vote of any candidate in around 25 years. So in that sense, it was a pretty historic election, especially in terms of participation of key groups like women and especially the youth. The youth throughout the world votes at a much lower rate than their older counterparts, and that's a big concern, but also one that people have sort of accepted as inevitable. Young people just end up voting less. So it was very good to see a case where it doesn't have to be that young people are voting so much less compared to older people, and that younger people are willing to make their voices heard and exert an influence on the outcomes of important things like elections.
What do you think young people were so involved in the last elections? I was surprised as well. I mean, I had my daughter's friends lined up, and I was like, are these guys supposed to be playing video games or just not really caring about this? What do you think changed the mind of a lot of young people?
I think they firstly wanted to take initiative of their own futures, but they also recognize that Zambia is at a pretty critical point in its history. Some of the problems that your country has had have always been there. So, for example, the over-reliance on copper as a part of the economy and copper exports. That's always been a problem. Countless governments throughout the years have promised to diversify the economy, to have less of a reliance, but it hasn't been delivered. So in that sense, there's a lot of disaffection as well. There's a recognition that while the country has made great leaps from where it was in 1963 or 64, just on the eve of independence in terms of things like education and literacy rates, there perhaps has been a bit of a stagnation in the last 20 or 30 years that is worrying, and that you should see things like the literacy rate continue to rise, not sort of flatten out when it gets to about 60-70%.
All right, we've going into what we're calling again. Zambia's going back to what this free education policy. I mean, would you know how bad we are doing when it comes to literacy levels in our country?
Yes, I mean, generally it has been a story of improvement from where it was 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah.
So that definitely should be celebrated. And late former founding president Kenneth Kaunda played a pretty vital role in ensuring that education was something that was focused on. But it's an issue that should always be focused on. One of the concerning things that our organization has seen about Zambia is that a lot of its national budget is devoted to two things, debt servicing and also payment for civil service.
Yeah.
And about 10% is devoted to the rest. Now, something like education should not really be in that 10% devoted to the rest, especially in a country where there's so many young people like Zambia. Ultimately, these people are the future of the country and they need to be invested in. So one signal which governments can show that they are serious about young people is in recognizing that we need to devote more resources to education, not only in building newer schools in areas which might need them, but also improving schools which currently do exist, ensuring that textbooks get there on time, ensuring that service delivery of things like piped water and electricity is a thing across schools across the country. This helps students a lot, and it will result in improved performance.
I mean, we talk about debt, and we will always be talking about debt and debt services. I mean, when you give us a figure like 10% is going to hospitals and going to schools and things like that, it's a huge deal. So I mean, why do you think we are allowing ourselves to borrow that much? I mean, do we really need that money, or can we make it ourselves?
I think that debt servings.
We were talking about the mines. Obviously, we're stuck with the mines because we know that there's money coming through it. Talking about diversification in the agriculture and other things that are sustainable for a longer period of time. Are we pointing the wrong direction for how we're going to develop our country?
I think diversification is very important. One of the things you notice when you look at any economic performance graph for Zambia or any economic performance data for Zambia is that the state of the country's economy tracks very closely to what the price of copper was in the previous quarter or year.
Mm.
And that's a concern if your country is that dependent on one specific material, where historically there has been a lot of fluctuations in sort of the ebbs and flows.
Right now it's at $11,000 per $11,000 in the London Stock Exchange. I mean, this is probably the highest it's been in a long time. Yeah.
So in general, as an organization, we're quite optimistic that higher copper prices are hopefully here to stay. One of the things that copper is very useful for is in helping with renewable sort of cars and electric cars, and it's a very important component of that. Zambia is, I think, the seventh largest export in the world of that, of copper, and so it is pretty important that copper continues to stay high, but also...
But it's not reliable.
Yeah, recognizing that it's not reliable, Zambian policymakers need to take advantage of the fact that prices are currently high to use those improved revenues to fund things like education or properly and sustainably fund diversification into agriculture, which still constitutes the vast majority of employment in this country. So it's very important to use your existing advantages, especially when they're at their peak, and divert funds into places which need to improve so that you're less reliant on future peaks and troughs in the copper market.
Yeah, but I mean, we still have debt that we need to service.
Yeah.
And we still have civil servants which we need to pay. I mean, there have been assertions that different organizations have been pushing for the reduction of the civil service, in order to aim money at something else. And a lot of people have been saying, but the government employs the most, and a lot of families would suffer if we reduce the civil service. And we talk about the debt. Obviously, the countries need their money back if we got it from them. What can we do? to get that 10% into debt instead of the 10% going into things that develop the country?
So the most important thing is to have an active citizenry. Ultimately, citizens are the ones who decide on the future of their country, and so they need to make clear what their priorities are. Things like civil servants' families coming under stress because of cuts to civil service payment is a pretty large concern, especially given that governments, especially in Southern Africa, are such large employers of people. You don't want that to have a knock-on effect either. So it does require some pretty careful planning to ensure that the blowback from making necessary investments into things like education and agricultural diversification and these sorts of things do happen, but at the same time ensuring that you do meet your debt commitments and also that you aren't sort of draconian in getting rid of civil servants en masse and therefore putting a lot of livelihoods at stake in that way.
But are you saying that, you know, civil servants are sitting in the office and not doing anything? We don't need them?
No, they are. They do essential work.
Yeah, I mean, they are, basically. But, I mean, you're saying there are too many, though.
Not necessarily that there are too many, but there does need to be a careful examination of the nature and state of civil service departments across the world, and but especially in Africa, because we have abundant young people in this continent, and therefore it needs to be such that you're creating opportunities for them not only through things like the civil service, but also in a thriving private sector. And as a result, you do need to balance budget commitments. These are politically tough decisions to make, but in many cases, necessary ones.
All right. I mean, when we talk about, I mean, I remember, God rest his soul, the Kenneth Galbraith talk about diversification. When FTJ came to talk about diversification, like Mwanawasa, we have Pierre Banda, and even now, the new president talking about diversification. Do you see it happening? I mean, especially with what's happening with our economy at this particular time. I mean, we should learn some lessons by now. It's been 50 years.
Yeah, it's been one of the stories of Zambia since independence, essentially, that there's an over-reliance on one source of material and the rest of the economy isn't as developed.
But isn't that just being lazy at the end of the day?
It somewhat is. There always needs to be.
You have money in the soil, you get it out, you sell it, you make the money, it comes back with the day that the copper is at 3,000, you go, the 3,000 are going to suffer because of copper. But still do not invest in agriculture, you don't invest in manufacturing, you don't invest in any of these. And I get surprised when the world changes.
Yeah, so which is why it's essential to take advantage of times when the copper price is higher. Now, we are pretty hopeful at Good Governance Africa that these higher copper prices are to an extent structural rather than based on a cycle. Because, like I said, they are very valuable material in building things like electric vehicles.
Yes.
And there is a growing demand of
for
that
electric vehicle
product. So there is room for investors, especially from the private sector and the international community. But it's also important that they involve local stakeholders in this process, because you need to take advantage of these copper prices, but also make sure that the dividends from taking advantage flow to the actual people who matter in the situation, which is the Zambian people. But you also use the increased revenue from that to identify other areas which would benefit the Zambian people in the future, like increased investment in education or increased investment in your agricultural industry, given how important it is. But also in things like improving the state of basic services in the country, making sure more and more people have access to things like electricity or piped water or sewerage and sanitation systems which work, so that their living standards and quality of life as a whole improve. And in order to do that, again, an active citizenry is essential.
All right. Dikazi, you were about to say something.
Yes. Good Governance Africa has been working across the continent and especially here in the sub-region. Perhaps you could state some of the statistical capacity and data infrastructure here in Zambia in the sub-region.
So this is one of the issues that I personally work quite a lot on, the state of statistical capacity and data infrastructure in Southern Africa, including places like Zambia. Overall, Zambia's story is one that's quite familiar to a lot of people across Africa who work in this area, where there was a lot of improvement after independence, but over the last 20 years, there's been stagnation and a slight decline. One of the concerns is still this perennial issue of access to rural areas. So that not only requires improving your ability to collect data from those areas, but also, again, it just comes back to investing more in your ability to access these people, making sure that the roads are good quality, making sure that there are fewer risks to data collectors. And another more pressing concern, which has come to light, obviously, in recent years, throughout the news, especially globally, there's a lot of focus on issues like data privacy, not only from governments, but also from private companies like Facebook and sort of these big social media companies which collect your data. In this regard, Zambia has shown at least some initiative. They have had at least two pieces of legislation devoted to sort of trying to protect the rights of citizens in terms of from things like data harvesting or people manipulating or taking advantage of Zambian data, which can obviously have a pretty massive impact on people's lives, especially in vulnerable communities. One of the things I do like about Zambia's approach is that they were willing to see that the existing law wasn't up to speed, even though it was quite a new law. It was only passed in 2009, and so they decided it needed to be re-updated. Having legislators who are sort of proactive on this issue is essential. Even if there are gaps in your legislation framework, the ability to monitor is about as important as well, because it lets you know where the flaws are in your system, and you can always be improving it.
Would you say governments are investing enough in data centers?
On the whole, in Africa, I don't think they are. It's very important. It's in the 21st century, it's been called new oil, which shows how important people, especially governments, think of it as being, but also business interests and international organizations and all these various important groups. I don't think there is enough investment in it, and also I don't think there's enough collaboration across the continent on it. There's some work done by places like the AU Commission and the African Development Bank, like I said, but also the regional economic communities have some role to play. But in this regard, there's a lot of inequality in terms of the state of that and each of their different capacities. The economic communities which Zambia is a part of, including SADC, are generally better compared to the rest of the continent, but being better relative to the rest of the continent should be something that people should be satisfied with. You should be seeking to compete with other parts of the developing world as a whole, places like Southeast Asia or South America, which do tend to have a lot better statistical capacities than even countries like South Africa or Egypt or Seychelles or Mauritius, which do have quite a high standard within the African context.
I mean, there's, I've been hearing it every time you say it, like you say active citizenry, it's been hitting me constantly, I mean, when you say active citizenry, are you saying that a lot of Zambians are not participating in their own governance? Or what are you trying to highlight when you say Zambia needs to have an active citizenry? Because I mean, so we hear it all the time, people call on radio all the time, they talk, but they don't have a lot of facts.
Yeah.
They just go
So fundamentally, it's about maintaining engagement, not only at the time of election. Historic voter turnout is something to be pretty proud of, especially if it's a reversal of a general decline in turnout across the continent, across the world, which is the case. But that's not enough. You have the legislative process is always ongoing. Government departments are always in charge of governing for a five-year cycle. It shouldn't be something that peaks every 5 years at regular intervals, because then governments can get away with things like corruption or suppressing information or not investing in things like education. Mm-hmm. So it's up to citizens to make sure that they're in contact with local officials or in contact with regional MPs and political parties and international organizations and non-profits like the one where I work, to ensure that there is pressure being applied on government to hold them account to their promises. We all know that political parties and leaders make a lot of promises during election periods.
A lot, yeah.
But it's important to also hold them accountable. You've made these pledges to us. Where's the improvement? Most people across Southern Africa, in my experience, are pretty reasonable in the expectations of governments. They recognize a lot of the legacy problems which the continent has due to things like colonialism and that, but also they want more, especially given how young the populations across Africa are. They do demand a greater stake in their future, and so sustaining that engagement across time, like we shouldn't actually put for the next 5 years, we should put more effort in. It should be always and constantly. That's what it means to live in a democracy, and so the citizens are the most key aspect of any democracy.
Yeah, but I always feel like, you know, them as citizens feel like politicians are so much more important than they are. And for instance, when we're talking about access to information, Bill, because there's a lot of speculation when it comes to even journalists and everybody when something is happening in their own country, because you can't access this information. You don't know what's really going on. All you do is hear this, hear that, but you can't go and really find that information. The new government has said that they will give us this access to information bill soon, but this is something that we've heard so many governments say. I mean, how important is this access to information?
It's essential for people to play a role in their own governance, which is fundamentally what democracy is about. It is about citizens having a voice and having an influence on policy directions. You aren't dictated to by some monarch or some self-proclaimed ruler or whatever. You choose your leaders, but you also hold them accountable. If they don't perform, you potentially change your vote. But you can also do more than that. You can run for local councils. You can get involved with local government, which is often the place where governments can have the most influence on the day-to-day lives of people. You can potentially get involved with local organizations, whether non-profits or even, if you incline in that way, political parties, and become an active part of the democracy and make sure that promises like giving access to information are actually kept by governments. Governments break promises across the world all the time, but firstly, the ability that we can highlight when these promises are broken, something to celebrate, because it means that at least we're aware that the problem exists. But beyond that, you have to make sure that you actually do get access, and that means not only being active, but also being smart about how active you are and in which directions.
Yeah, because I feel them is only feel powerful when it's the time to vote. The rest of the 5 years, they're scared to talk. I mean, they're scared to express themselves because they feel, okay, now these guys have power. We are nothing now. How powerful are we?
Still very powerful. Because you can still put pressure on courses of direction where governments are clearly taking a direction where you are unhappy. Public protest was a very important aspect of liberation struggles all across Southern Africa, and it showed that people were very felt very strongly about this and wanted to have a stake in whatever future system was had. The sort of commitment and sacrifice which were made by previous generations need to be sustained by future generations as well. They need to be as active as their forefathers and foremothers in terms of ensuring that there is consistent pressure applied on governments to uphold the promises, but also a willingness to work with governments to ensure that there is a policy-making process which is collaborative. People in a democracy can't be policy takers. They also need to be involved in the issues which matter, and having seen that issue.
Yeah, they say numbers don't lie. And thank you very much for letting us know that we should be, looking at the numbers and not looking at them as our enemies, but as a process for us to develop certain things. Thank you very much, Pranish. Any last words you'd like?
No, I'd just like to reiterate that governance fundamentally is about not only having effective governments which can make policy, but also having a citizenry which is willing to participate in that process. And at Good Governance Africa, we do a lot of work in this regard, and we advise both governments and citizens and other non-profits and international organizations about this sort of work. For more information, they can drop us an email at info@goodgovernance@gga.org or visit our website at www.gga.org.
All right. Well, sure, I'll be looking at that the website pretty soon. Pretty interesting. Thank you very much for giving us an insight.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
All right, that's the sort of breakfast show coming up. I'll be back with the news headlines. Stay tuned.
Breakfast on Copperbelt's hottest station. Sun FM.
Start your day right.
That's when we come in.
Shut up!
We bring the music, the chat,